from the Allstate Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for September the 29th, 2019. Yes, the last Sunday of September. October beckons. Welcome to our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we take you from City Hall to the State House and all the way on to the White House. So, time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. And we got to try, because with this weather, it's, you know, if it's Sunday, it must be rain, right? This is three Sundays in a row, Dave.
I know it is. I know. And the rain will continue through the morning. As we mentioned a couple of times in the news, Rick, a flash flood watch in effect until 10 this morning. Now, that is specifically for our entire listening area that will be the case. We also have flood warnings posted for places like Grundy County, LaSalle County, until tomorrow. Here's one until further notice for Bureau, LaSalle, and Putnam counties. Of a flash flood warning until further notice for Winnebago County. So, you know, we have this going on.
Yeah.
And that will continue to be the case. There have been areas that have received 8 inches of rain.
Unbelievable.
And that storm that Friday night moved through, that was quite a thunderstorm. I hadn't seen one like
that.
Yeah,
that was a fireworks show.
It was
right.
A fireworks show, yes. Yeah. And, you know, you have to think also what this additional rain is going to do to our already very, very high lake levels.
Yes.
I it's amazing when you walk along the lakeshore how high this lake is. I tell people that it should be a foot and a half or so lower than what you see coming over the breakwaters.
Right. Oh, it's unbelievable, all of this rain. Just unbelievable. And, you know,
I guess... You want moisture? We've got moisture.
and of course, it's always fun to come to work in the rain.
Oh,
and,
sure.
You know, particularly at the times that we come in on Sunday morning. And as I'm walking over here, of course, it's kind of dark out. So I didn't see the puddle that I walked into that immediately covered up my ankles with water. So
no wonder you came in here saying
well,
you came in
this
morning.
That most Sunday mornings. I was up to my ankles in
you weren't
water.
Your bright and cheery self.
Come on. when's the last time you saw that, Dave? What year?
Well, so, yeah, rain, I'm now looking at a story of a record snowstorm that's threatening Montana.
Jeez.
And then temperatures tomorrow here in the 80s.
In the 80s, yes. And, of course, today is my day to go to Chicago
the
Gourmet Festival.
Gourmet Festival. Yeah, that's a tradition with you.
Yes, and I at least know better than to wear good shoes for this.
So you'll wear your wet shoes.
Yes, Millennium Park's going to be very interesting to traverse today. But rain or shine, bring on the food festival.
Yeah.
That's what I say.
Right. So, again, the flooding continuing, flood advisories for really our entire listening area going on. This will continue through the day today.
Well, I guess, you know, the weather kind of describes a perfect way to segue into a final Sunday of baseball season in Chicago.
the weather just kind of... exemplifies the team's successes. I don't know. I think it was not a very promising year, but a lot of good things came of the White Sox season.
Absolutely. Yeah. I do agree. That team is on an upward trajectory. There is no doubt about that.
And it looks like Tim Anderson's going to win the batting crown. Jose Abreu's going to win the ALRBI crown. I mean, there's a lot of things moving forward. And, you know, we were talking before the show about the manager speculation. What's going to happen next year with the Cubs? That's going to be interesting too. That whole process.
Well, I figure you're on full time Madden watch today.
I feel like everyone is now too.
Yes,
though.
That's true.
You know, just every slight little update that's going on with that situation. It is going to be interesting though, and like we were talking about, a lot of people are going to miss him when he is gone. No matter what you felt about him managing and how this season came to an end, which, again, I'm in the belief that it's not entirely Joe Maddon's fault. I mean, there's issues outside the manager that are a result of the Cubs' failures this year. But a lot of people are going to miss his little shticks and how he talks to
his
the media.
Quirks.
Yeah, that's definitely going to be missed.
But I think, you know, there is a time and a place for some tough love here.
I agree.
And
just a change in the leadership of the voice of the clubhouse. I think that always can do a team good.
Right. Yes. And but it will be curious to see what happens for next season and who comes in.
Yeah, I honestly, I haven't the slightest
I don't either.
Idea. I mean, everyone says either Mark Loretta, apparently Mark DeRosa's name is being thrown around, David Ross. I mean, I guess I understand all of them, but why one over the other? The whole David Ross thing, just he's never coached.
Right.
I get it. He's a catcher, and catchers make good managers, and they see both sides of the game. But, you know, why is David Ross going to fix the Cubs? There's no argument for that.
Yeah, I don't see that. I've heard the talk as well. I just don't see that. I don't know what he brings. I mean, yeah, he was fine as a clubhouse veteran for the championship year, but after that, how does that translate into being a manager?
Right, I agree, and a lot of people just lean that way because when catchers are good with the media and a good spark in the clubhouse, then yep, they're going to be great managers, and that's just not the case all the time. Look at Mike Matheny.
Right. Yes. Good example. Good example. Right.
And to be clear, I'm not comparing David Ross to Mike Matheny. I'm just saying, you know.
Right. No. Point well taken. What do we think from our Bears today?
I think this is going to be one of the... This is one of the more challenging games in the year because you headed into Green Bay thinking, all right, this is the opportunity for the Bears to just blow away Green Bay for the first time in a while, and they came out with an absolute dud. You don't know what's going to happen with the Denver game. They squeak away with a one-point victory. They finally play a game to their expectations against Washington, and now you actually have a matchup that you can see going either way. You got two nearly Super Bowl-caliber defenses facing off against each other, and I think it's going to come down to, once again, how solid Mitch can be with this offense going against a strong defense like that in Minnesota.
And I have to wonder if weather doesn't play a little factor in.
Yeah, that's a good point. Maybe we see a lot more of David Montgomery today. And
a sloppy track.
just taking advantage of putting the ball on the ground. We'll see. I'd like to see them implement that a little bit more, the running game. But
well, I mean, our passing game is largely, you know, 7 yards. I mean, that's what it looks like to me.
Right, right.
If it's rainy, I can't see for a change in that passing game.
And, you know, how great can Mitch be in a circumstance like this, or conditions like this, rather?
Right.
You know, is it just better to give the ball to Montgomery, break some tackles, and go ahead, buddy?
Well, I know. I'm sure I'll be hearing from my Aunt Jo up in Minnesota on my text line today. I'm rooting for the Bears, but and it's a division game. That's why the stakes are even higher here. And plus, I'm probably going to be keeping an eye on Kansas City. The Chiefs playing the Lions today, too.
Right? Yeah, that tie is really throwing things into a funk with the standings.
Was all of a sudden I look and I'm going, they tied? How did they tie? I don't even remember who they tied with.
Philadelphia, I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
It was it last week? Yeah, it came down and both teams nearly had an opportunity to win. I'm sorry, it was not Philadelphia. It was Arizona. That's right.
Okay.
That was the first game of the year.
Okay.
That Arizona should have won in overtime towards the end. I don't know where I'm getting Philadelphia.
the Eagles on the brain.
Well, I came in with my Bears jacket, and I reached into my pocket, And my Bears winter cap was on it. I haven't worn the jacket since the playoff game last year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I was like, what is this doing? And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. I put it in the closet.
Memories.
I put it in the closet with that year's fandom. And I was like, I'll wait till next year.
Well, hopefully this is a good omen then.
But, yeah, that's a good point.
Let's see what happened in that. But of course, you know, they have this weird schedule this year too. This the 3 o'clock game today.
Everyone is so frustrated that they can't watch the Bears at noon, and it's so ironic that the first noon game is going to be next week in London.
Yes, right. Of all places,
it takes them going across the seas to play a noon game.
Well, and so they're going to London. We've got the Blackhawks who are in Berlin,
right.
And then off to Prague for Friday's season opener, which is a 1 o'clock afternoon game.
Yeah, that's another odd thing because it's a Friday, right?
Right.
So
I'll be watching. I guarantee you, I'll be watching. I'm not sure where yet, but I will definitely be watching.
I feel like a lot of people will, be at work and stream the game.
Stream the game. And
ask for a half day or
something.
Listen
to it here on WGN, of course. And hockey season, welcome. Welcome.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Much looking forward to it.
Please come and save the day.
Yes. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Joe's here, of course, with the latest sports. Producer Cassara's here to field your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. You can text us at 312-981-7200. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. And Engineer Bob is taking the newsroom Zamboni out of storage and getting the oil changed. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here in the WGN Skyline Studios. Time to launch our spin through weekly politics, national politics, and of course, leading off with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announcing the launch of a formal impeachment proceedings against President Donald Trump over Trump's call to Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky in seeking to dig up dirt against potential 2020 rival, former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter Biden. Here is the Speaker of the House.
The actions of the Trump presidency revealed the dishonorable fact of the president's betrayal of his oath of office, betrayal of our national security, and betrayal of the integrity of our elections. Therefore, today, I'm announcing the House of Representatives moving forward with an official impeachment inquiry.
Now, Adam Schiff, who chairs the House Intelligence Committee, that'll be the committee that'll be leading the impeachment efforts, says that the president engaged in a mafia-style shakedown.
The notes of the call reflect a conversation far more damning than I or many others had imagined. It is shocking at another level that the White House would release these notes and felt that somehow this would help the president's case or cause. Because what those notes reflect is a classic mafia-like shakedown of a foreign leader. They reflect a Ukrainian president who was desperate for U.S. support, for military support to help that country in a hot war with Putin's Russia, a country that is still occupied by irregular Russian forces, and in which people face a very dangerous and continuing and destabilizing action by their aggressive neighbor. And at the same time, a president of the United States who immediately after Ukraine president expresses the need for further weapons tells the Ukraine president that he has a favor to ask.
That is the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff. Up ahead on your Sunday Spin, after the news and sports at 7:30, we'll speak to Michael Kotvanargi. He's a current member of the Cook County Board of Review and a candidate for Cook County Circuit Clerk. And we'll talk to him about his campaigns and some reforms for the office that he's proposed. At the top of the hour, we'll speak to David Treader. David's the president of the Federation of Independent Illinois Colleges and Universities. And we'll talk to him about higher education and enrollment among his member institutions, whether things have stabilized, whether things have improved after that lengthy historic two-year budget impasse took its toll not only on public colleges and universities, but also the private colleges and universities as well. We'll get a final check of the news and sports at 8:30, and then we'll speak to a good friend of the program, strategist Michael Golden. He's the president of Golden Means Strategies, and we'll discuss with him the move by the House Democrats to move forward on impeachment.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. At the United Nations General Assembly last week, sitting aside Trump, the Ukrainian President Zelensky said that he didn't feel pressured by Trump's phone call on Biden. It's also clear he really doesn't want to be involved.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be involved to democratic, open, elections of USA. No, you heard that we had, good phone call. It was normal. We spoke about many things, and I think... And you read it that nobody pushed me. Yes.
In other words, no pressure.
Now that's the Ukrainian president saying that. Joseph McGuire, the acting director of National Intelligence, he was called before the House Intelligence Committee to testify about the delay in conveying that whistleblower complaint to Congress. Here's Joseph McGuire.
I am not familiar with any prior instances where a whistleblower complaint touched on such complicated and sensitive issues, including executive privilege. I believe that this matter is unprecedented.
This matter is unprecedented, and we'll be talking about it much more in the days and weeks ahead. Well, joining me now here in the Skyline studio is Mike Kotvanargi. How do you say this? I'm sorry. I keep putting the R in the wrong place, Mike. I apologize.
You should see some of the junk mail I get. Kotvanargi.
Mike Kotvanargi, who is on the Cook County Board of Review currently, but he's also a candidate for Cook County Circuit Clerk. Mike, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me here.
You have proposed, obviously this is now an open seat with Dorothy Brown not seeking re-election. You are the Cook County Democratic slated candidate to replace her in the campaign for this open seat. And you proposed a series of numerous reforms for this office. And I think for people who are familiar with the office, this is an office that's in desperate need of updating, and not just technology, but just in culture. If that's a fair statement.
Yeah,
so absolutely. why don't we talk about some of these? You mentioned one thing is transparency.
Yes.
What are we talking about here?
Sure. So as you pointed out, we're laying down our marker for reform here. It's an office, the clerk of the court's office, that is still stuck in the 20th century. You have to bring carbon paper to the courtrooms to write out your orders. Nobody likes it. The judges, the parties, nobody wants to be in court in the first place. And when you're there, the process shouldn't be made simpler. And really, our staples here of our reform: technology, transparency, and talent, and then also social justice. And as to transparency, we want to take a look at the fees and the fines that go to the court. Cook County has some of the highest court fines and fees in the country. Those can be a real barrier to access for folks who need to go to court to receive their justice. And it's interesting, the Illinois Supreme Court last year issued a report, and they looked at fees and fines, and transparency came up because they said, well, people are more willing to pay for a fee if they understand what it goes for, as to a fine where they don't understand why they're paying the fine. So part of that is explaining to folks who use the courts, what are the fees? And then for the court itself, do we need to charge all these fees? Do we need all these fines?
Well, I was going to say, I mean, there's, and there, and you know, covering Springfield, that there's always a constant kind of slapping on another fee or fine to go to some dedicated cause, and you know, it starts, you know, looking like a laundry list on some of these cases.
Yeah, right now the fees and fines have gone up. So if you go to the courts right now and just want to plead guilty on a moving violation, it's $254 just on fees and fines. You want to come in and say, I did it. First of all, you can't do it online. The clerk of the court system doesn't allow you to pay your moving violation online. So you have to take a half day off work, go to traffic court, step up. Say, I just want to plead.
It's already costing you for not going to work, plus what you're paying for here.
Yeah, and plus you get it stamped guilty. You go in, you wait in line to go pay $254 to pay guilty. So you've taken time off work. You have to show up in court. You have to pay in person, and it's $254 just right off the bat. That whole process needs to be rethought out. You can use your phone to buy a car. You should be able to pay a moving violation on your phone.
How much of that? I mean, does that require approval of the court?
So the Illinois Supreme Court has implemented e-filing as the law of the land. The Cook County Clerk of Court's office has been slow in executing that, administering that. I think part of that is the leadership.
Glacially slow,
indeed. You know, I spent most of my career in the federal courts. I used to be a federal prosecutor, and then I was a law clerk for a federal judge here. And so the federal courts have had electronic filing for 30 years through a system called PACER. It's not sexy. But it's durable and it gets the job done, and there's no reason we can't move to an all digital system.
I mean, that to me is just the stunner of things, is that it's still so antiquated.
Yeah, I mean, at the Board of Review, or as you mentioned, I've been a commissioner, and we when I came to the Board of Review 8 years ago, to file a property tax appeal for your home, you had to get a paper form in triplicate. We moved that to an all digital platform, and now 93% of our property tax appeals in Cook County are filed online. We've given tens of thousands of square footage back to the county. Meanwhile, the clerk of the court's office just spent $24 million to build a document warehouse in Cicero. So it's paper for now, paper for the future. I mean, we need to take a look at digital solutions to get rid of these warehouses.
I don't think we need to spend $24 million for cloud storage.
Absolutely. No, and that's an opportunity. Let's take a look at all the paper. Let's identify it. Let's back scan it. Let's do optical character recognition. Let's put it online. And back to transparency, let's say what we've got. Cook County has this great open data initiative right now where we work with all, not just the Board of Review, but all the offices in Cook County to say, all this great data we've got, is there a way to take a look at it? If there's non-sensitive data that's in the court system, let's get that scanned electronically so folks can go through that all and see what we can learn.
Yeah, I mean, I would think there's, you know, some great value in having access to all of that, and access that you can easily get to rather than trying to hunt down pieces of paper in a warehouse.
And we've seen it right now. When you talk to the judges and the practitioners right now to step in, when they have a case step before them, and I've talked to a number of judges and lawyers who are practicing in Cook County, the process is slow. And it's not fair to their parties. And again, it's really not fair to the people who go to the courthouses to receive their
justice. It's not fair for the justice system.
Exactly. And if everybody else is doing their job, the prosecutors, the defense bar, the judges, the holdup shouldn't be the administrator of the courts who's keeping the paperwork together. That should be a seamless process.
That should just roll right in.
You shouldn't even know where we're operating. The clerk of the court's office should be operating in the back room smoothly, and so you don't even know they're there, instead of being up front. I mean, the other example I give to folks is, you know, the real practical effects it has on people. So the state appellate defender's office is the agency that appoints counsel if you've been convicted for an appeal. They'll take a look at your case, and if they believe you have a case that merits appeal, they'll appoint a lawyer. There are 600 individuals in jail right now who are the state appellate defender has appointed a lawyer to them, but they can't get into court for their appeal because the trial record isn't complete. So they've got a lawyer, the judge wants to docket the case for a hearing, but the trial record isn't there, and they're still in jail. Every year, the state appellate defender sends a letter over to the chief judge to say, help us. We've got hundreds of people waiting in jail, but the clerk of the court can't get the record together. That's unacceptable.
We're speaking with Mike Cabanargi. He is a member of the Cook County Board of Review and candidate for Cook County Circuit Clerk. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune. Speaking with Mike Cabanargi, he is a candidate for Cook County Circuit Clerk, and we're talking about some of the proposed changes in modernization in the office. I have to tell you, one thing I thought was interesting, eliminate patronage jobs.
Yeah.
I never thought I would see that as a proposal.
From the clerk of the court's office?
Yes, yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
Public employees, whatever office you're in, owe a duty of loyalty not to the office holder but to the public. So again, this gets back to taking a look at the office and bringing in transparency, technology, and then ultimately talent. On day one, we'll do a forensic investigation. Before I was at the Board of Review, I spent many years as a senior attorney and a prosecutor with the Securities and Exchange Commission, and I've seen how valuable it can be to bring in a third-party forensic investigator looking for specific instances of misconduct, but also taking a step back and looking at procedures and policies. And again, I think that's going to pull back the curtain on, do we need all the jobs, and is everybody's job titled? You know, people unfortunately look at automation and think that you're starting with as it's a tool for job loss. At the Board of Review, when we digitized our system, we weren't looking to eliminate jobs. We were looking to do our jobs better. And part of it is, are people's jobs titled correctly? Do they have the correct duties and responsibilities? Do they have the correct organization chart? So again, that gets back into, on day one, with a forensic investigator coming in and working with me and the leadership team, is everybody doing the right job? And if you can't walk up to somebody in any job, private sector, public sector, pick up a piece of paper in front of them and say, what does this paper mean? What does this do? Who do you report to? If they can't answer those questions, why do I need them?
That could be a full-time process just of doing that, the organizational charts and whether people are you know, supposed to be where they're supposed to be.
Yeah, and it's and again, at the Board of Review, when I was building our digital system, and it's one of the reasons I want to be the clerk of the court, it's not that we didn't, for that year, hear the appeals for 1.3 million properties in Cook County while we were building a digital system. We had to do both. My hearing officers and analysts and I were still reviewing all the tax appeals. Meanwhile, we're building this new IT infrastructure. You have to do both. And as you mentioned, we're going to have to implement new technology, implement transparency, identify good employees, identify bad employees, recognize and reward the talent, get rid of everyone else. You have to do everything at the same time. Meanwhile, being the clerk for one of the largest consolidated court systems in the country.
Mike, I want to ask you a Board of Review question, and this is because of something that I saw recently in the news involving Fritz Kagi, the assessor, involving this property is involving the northern suburbs of Cook County and incorporating the use of floodplain and concerns of that in the assessment of property. And what I'm seeing is these are some very, very expensive pieces of property that are going to be seeing massive reductions in their assessment because now a floodplain map is being incorporated as a factor in the assessment. And ultimately, I guess this comes to the Board of Review.
Exactly.
Can you tell me what's going on here?
Sure. So I think it's, taking a step back, I think it's good for the assessor to use more and better data whenever possible. There's a lot of data points that are available, and the assessor is trying to implement more data when possible. So in this situation, what happened is, as I understand it, was the assessor had opened and closed a number of townships for appeal, and while we was doing the new Trier Township, realized that the FEMA floodplain maps were available.
Easy for you to say, yes. FEMA floodplain maps.
When your name is Kevin Argent, you better with that roll off your tongue. The FEMA floodplain maps and implemented them in his model. And again, to your point, it's important to realize the assessor does is macro and the Board of Review is micro. He's using a mass assessment model and he's plugging in data.
It's like a template.
A template, exactly. And in this case, approximately 1,100 homes in New Trier would get a reduction. The problem was he had already closed New Trier and sent the final values to the Board of Review. And in this situation, he said, well, let's go with what's called a certificate of correction process. So the certificate of correction process sends over a paper file with some analysis and a cover sheet. We get about 30 to 40 of those from the assessor a year. It's really kind of fat finger errors, key punch errors. But in this case, it was 1,100. So we talked to the assessor. Our staffs have been talking, working through whether the certificate of correction process is really the best way, or should we just have a regular hearings and appeals on these individually? I think my colleagues and I are thinking it fits best if we just have these files come to our office as individual files, and we'll have individual hearings on them.
On a case-by-case basis.
Exactly.
Because, I mean, we are talking about, you know, multi-million dollar properties that would see multi-million dollar reductions, and I would have to assume, you know, when you, the market value for those homes, the market hasn't been hurt by the fact that they are located in a floodplain.
Right, and I think, you know, one argument we're going to hear and we have to have a conversation with the appellants on is how is that floodplain data not cooked into the sales price? You purchased a home in a floodplain, and that evidence should be cooked into the sales price. Maybe it's not. Maybe there's evidence there we're missing. But let's hear about it on individual cases, case by case.
Well, and I would assume in some of these properties, too, that there's significant mitigation efforts.
Great point, too.
That are cooked into the price of the house, too.
You know, some of these communities have spent a lot of money on infrastructure for floodplain management. So has that decreased the value of the home? Could it increase the value of the home? We want to take a look at these on a case-by-case basis.
One other thing I want to talk to you about, and we were talking off-air about this, is you're part of the delegate selection process for the Democratic Party of Illinois. When it goes to the fact of presidential Democratic nominating delegates that are going to the convention in Milwaukee. This is a very nerdy process. I understand that because I've wrote about it. Yeah. And but I guess one of the factors is, unlike a usual election time, and next month, I mean October 5th, just next week, candidates for president and delegates start circulating nominating petitions to get on the March 2020 ballot. So there is a time situation here, but you have so many candidates, and you got to put together a slate of delegates to maximize your opportunity as a candidate. And I'm curious whether, you know, are people jumping on board with these candidates? And I get some of the feeling that among, you know, some of the named people here in the party, no one wants to jump too soon because they're not sure who's still going to be in this thing, and nobody wants to back a loser.
Yeah. So in addition to my job as commissioner, along with Congressman Chuy Garcia and Robin Kelly and some others, I'm vice chair of the Democratic Party in Illinois. And one thing that we talked about as the 2020 presidential season was unwinding, or starting to gear up, I should say, was that we had heard from a lot of folks in 16 that the delegate process was opaque. They didn't understand how to become a delegate. So we decided to do, and in the end, we did approximately 21
hearings.
21 hearings throughout.
Or training sessions.
Trainings, yeah. And we call them delegate information sessions to tell folks just the fundamentals. To your point, you have to run to be a delegate. So the state party or local officials are not selecting you. Rather, you go to a presidential campaign and say, I live in the 5th congressional district. I live in the 9th congressional district. I would like to be a delegate for Biden, Harris, Warren, Mayor Pete, whomever. And they will review you. And then you, if you are selected, will get signatures on a petition and run as a candidate. And if you're elected, you get to go to the convention where, as we pointed out, you have to pay for your hotel.
Yes, indeed.
You pay for your meals. Sometimes people show up and go, but I thought the parties were going to pay my way. And we pat them on the back and we say, Welcome to the inside of the party. you're paying for your own freight here. But it really, the level of excitement I've seen at these information sessions, I've led a couple of them. I think the one we had at the Broadway Armory 2 weeks ago had 300 people. We had another one in Evanston that had 175 people. Folks are fired up for 2020. They're fired up to support our nominee, whoever she or he is. And they, being the convention, is really the starting gun for our party to come out stronger and take it on to Donald Trump in November.
It's quite a process.
It is, and all eyes are going to be on it.
Absolutely. Mike Carbonargi, he is the candidate for Cook County Circuit Clerk and current member of the Cook County Board of Review. Mike, thanks so much for joining me this
Rick,
morning.
Thanks for having me today.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning, and welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. At a closed-door fundraiser in New York last week, President Trump likened the whistleblower and the information the whistleblower obtained to an issue of spies and spying. And he reminded his audience that spies used to be punished quite severely.
But basically, that person never saw the report, never saw the call, and he never saw the call, heard something, and decided that he or she, whoever the hell it is, sort of like almost a spy. I want to know who's the person that gave the whistleblower, who's the person that gave the whistleblower the information? Because that's close to a spy. You know what we used to do in the old days where we were smart, right? With spies and treasons. We used to handle it a little differently than we do now.
Used to handle it a little differently than we do now. And that line was met by laughter. Now, how have things changed in Washington? Well, here's South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, who's now one of the president's staunchest defenders, explaining the process of impeachment 20 years ago.
So the point I'm trying to make is you don't even have to be convicted of a crime to lose your job in this constitutional republic. If this body determines that your conduct as a public official is clearly out of bounds in your role. Because impeachment is not about punishment. Impeachment is about cleansing the office. Impeachment is about restoring honor and integrity to the office.
That's Lindsey Graham, circa 1999, about the issue of impeachment. We're going to bring things closer to home now, and joining me now on the phone is David Treader. He's president of the Federation of Independent Illinois Colleges and Universities. David, thanks so much for joining me.
Good morning.
I wanted to have you on because I've always had a great interest in the issue of higher education and how higher education stands in this state. And obviously coming off the two-year period where the state of Illinois had a historic budget impasse, which no doubt adversely hurt public colleges and universities, but also had an effect on private colleges and universities, the issues like the monetary award program grants, things like that. And I guess I'm kind of curious, I wanted to have you on to perhaps maybe you could give us kind of a state of the state as far as higher education when it comes to the private colleges and universities in Illinois.
Well, right, thanks. The privates haven't quite taken the hit, at least in terms of enrollment, that the publics have. Over the last, let's say, 10 years, including that two-year budget impasse. But I think one of the things that's continuing to have kind of a rippling effect is, I guess, what I would call the reputational damage done to Illinois higher education. And remember that when we were going through that budget impasse, that wasn't happening in a vacuum. States around us, Indiana, Wisconsin, Iowa, et cetera, were ramping up, because the reality is Illinois and Chicago specifically is a place to get students. And that effect, even though we're hopefully on the road to recovery, we've got one kind of decent budget behind us, it's going to take a while, I think, to get not only the reputation that was damaged back, but frankly, kind of some solid financial footing into all these institutions, including, as you mentioned, MAP grants. And And I guess the final thing I would say on that is when students leave the state, you know, many of them come back, but this is, I think, now part of a larger Illinois story about individuals leaving our state, not only college students, but just residents in general. So it's a piece of that puzzle, and it's concerning.
Well, and obviously the issue of out-migration of high school graduates to other universities, as you touched on, that other schools around the country were basically setting up shop here in Illinois and going full-time heavy recruitment efforts. And I'm not sure that that stopped.
No, you know, in my time, which is too many years, when I started, there was about 10 shops set up in the Chicago area from out-of-state institutions. Now there's north of 150. So pragmatically, Illinois probably is always going to be a state that exports a number of college students. That's kind of baked in just to the demographics and the geography of Illinois.
Well,
what we set up was an incentive to leave.
Pardon me? I'm sorry.
Yeah, what we set up was an incentive for students to leave by not funding higher ed.
Right, right. Well, and you know, you've got that issue of students going out of state for their higher education. But also, isn't there kind of an issue, too, of just the universe of high school graduates in the state is not as large as it used to be?
Right, and that maybe is part of the perfect storm, for lack of a better term, that our numbers have tapered off, our high school grad numbers have tapered off. So just the available population of students that want to enroll in college is decreasing. And that's kind of a Midwestern phenomena, too, but that doesn't help when you're trying to drive more enrollment in higher education.
And so with the smaller pot, then it's a battle of, the individual institutions here in Illinois going after that smaller universe of students. And that can lead to pitting private versus public against each other, can't it?
Absolutely. And it's a hyper competitive market on both quality, price, cost. We see reports every day, the debt bubble, student loan debt bubble, other things. The reality is most Illinois residents are looking either for themselves or their children to find a path through higher education. And I think that leads to we really haven't had a good solid game plan as it pertains to higher education for about 10 years. And so a number of us in higher ed are saying, hey, we got to sit down and look first at what do we have here? We have 12 public universities, almost 50 community colleges, and over 100 private institutions. Well, let's see what we got. What are our resources and our capacity, and figure out the best path forward to get all these institutions kind of, firing on all cylinders to first keep students in Illinois and do a good job of, if that happens, I think that will help in retaining residents here.
Is there an issue of overcapacity?
Yeah, that's a fair question. And I think there's some evidence there, both from what you said earlier, decreasing high school grad numbers. And so I think what you saw during the budget impasse, and you could probably describe it as kind of a Darwinian experience or experiment on the public universities who have downsized, probably a term you might say is right-sized, but at my institutions, our enrollments are level, but I don't think you're going to see huge growth in enrollment numbers. So there is a compression. I think you're exactly right. And that puts pressure on institutions surviving, too, frankly, around the state.
We're making a point I tend to agree, is that, the whole idea of the budget impasse certainly raised to a new level, some critical questions that existed in higher education as far as public school, as far as, what kind of programs are offered, is there too much repetition, are there efficiencies that can be built into the system, it came, all of those hard questions came at a pretty steep price, too, as far as you said, the whole kind of badge of Illinois in higher education and kind of getting branded as not necessarily, a trustworthy state for students.
Well, right. I mean, I had just locally here, and I'm a Springfield guy. Parents would ask me, should I send my kids to an Illinois institution? Are they going to be there in 4 or 5 years? And, you know, I assured them they would be, but clearly all of the factors you've just mentioned, along with, you know, frankly, the decreasing population and high school numbers, lead back to what I said earlier. We can't just kind of fake our way through this. We got to take a hard look at this and have some kind of plan going forward.
We're speaking with David Treader. He is president of the Federation of Independent Illinois Colleges and Universities. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the WGN Skyline Studios. And on the phone with David Treader, president of the Federation of Independent Illinois Colleges and Universities. We've been talking about kind of the state of the state of the independent colleges and universities. We kind of know what the state of the state is when it comes to the public colleges and universities. But David, I was curious, you know, you touched on the issue of, you know, concerns about student debt. We see the stories every day. But is there an issue about sticker shock and competitiveness involving private colleges and universities?
Yeah, I think that's always there because, in fact, because we're nonprofit privates, that initial sticker price is higher. But I encourage people to and put their applications in at a private, because it's a negotiated process. And in fact, what you find out is that the privates are, in fact, very affordable here. And I guess the proof's in the pudding, in the fact that you know, the private institutions in the state now enroll more than the public universities. So it's a good value, good return on investment, and people are voting with their feet at private colleges.
Well, is part of it the fact that public school tuitions have dramatically increased in the state, that it's the playing field's a bit closer to being leveled?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. With budget numbers going the wrong way, and the public's, I think, understandably having to respond with raising tuition prices, that gap, if you will, between public and private has closed over the years.
Plus, I think too, there's, you know, perhaps a certain draw on the fact that you know, these are, for the most part, you know, these are not the mass market kind of schools like University of Illinois or Illinois State, where you're able to find institutions that kind of are more tailored to a student's interests, or maybe not being in a class of 200 people being taught by a research assistant.
Well, that's the beauty, and I think the way I like to describe it is finding the right fit for a particular student. And if you're, let's say you're at Knox College up in Galesburg, 1,000 students, you're going to be seen, you're going to be noticed. So students are different. Some like the large campus. You can even find that in my institutions, DePaul, Loyola, Northwestern, and we have big institutions, but really there's a wide range of kind of offerings and fit and programs at our institutions. And I argue in the General Assembly, it's one of the best deals the state has. Private institutions here, we educate 60% of the healthcare folks. Think about what's coming at us demographically in terms of healthcare professionals, and 40% of the teachers. I can go down the list, but in a very important contributor to higher education, and I think needs to be part of that discussion going forward as to how we fit all these pieces together and what's best for the state and for folks looking for higher education.
But you keep talking about that discussion. Is that discussion happening?
But not as much as I would like, and there's kind of two prongs to it. A number of us, both public and private, have approached the new administration, and I think there is some interest by Governor Pritzker and his staff to take a look at that. But the other piece we need, and it's something I've been working on for a number of years, is we need other external validation, for lack of a better term. We need business folks. We need community leaders. We need mayors. Some of this we've captured and done during the budget impasse, but especially on the business side, business leaders, we think, should be standing at the podium, so to speak, with higher ed officials saying we need to get this figured out because it's in the interest of the state business environment, and along with just the benefits of the personal benefits of folks that get a higher education.
So who has to lead this convening? I mean, is it a matter of the governor actually kind of weighing in here, or you know, some kind of task force or something like that?
Well, I think that's what it's going to take, and I hesitate to say we need another blue ribbon committee. You know where that leads, but short of that, there needs to be some effort. I do think it's got to come. There's got to be some leadership out of the governor's office or one of the deputy governors. I think there is some interest there to do that, but it's got to engage not only higher ed, but as I said, other stakeholders.
Well, then that's what I mean. Does it take somebody like a governor to have to do this to bring in those other stakeholders like the business community?
Yeah, I think it probably does. And governors have a lot of power in that regard, and also have a lot of power in how they develop their budgets. And, you know, certainly we're encouraged by Governor Pritzker's first budget, which, you know, there was a low bar, right? After the last year.
Well, and I wonder, yeah. I mean, you know, everybody talks about, you know, kudos. Hey, we got a budget. You know, things are rolling. But it really has been a low bar.
Yeah, unfortunately. And higher, maybe social services took a harder hit than higher education. But if you look through what happened, higher education, either by design or by accident, was really a target of the last budget impasse. And, so there's a lot of work to be done to try to get firm footing back under higher ed.
There's a lot of people who think it's by design.
Yeah, it was hard to see it was by accident. It certainly looked like the higher ed was a target. And I think now you're seeing why it mattered. With students leaving and the unpredictability and all of those things that come with that, you know, a couple, two, 3 years out. And that's why we need to get back on track.
Well, it's certainly something that we're going to have to be watching more closely, because Illinois has a great historic value in its higher education community, public and private, and it's been some very jarring times. There's no doubt about it. David Treader, president of the Federation of Independent Illinois Colleges and Universities. David, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks, Rick.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Just a couple of notes here. One, my friends at the Literacy Volunteers of Illinois are having their annual Scrabble for Literacy Challenge. That's coming up on October 12th. From 3 to 7 at the Literacy Center at 641 West Lake Street on the third floor. You can get more information by going to the Literacy Volunteers of Illinois website, and that's lvillinois.org, and you'll see the little icon for the Scrabble tournament there. I will probably be stopping by to have a couple of quick games there for Scrabble for Literacy. I'd encourage you to support them. Also want to congratulate Rich Coes for 40 years of broadcasting greatness. The Chicago City Council honored Rich and Sven Gulli with a special resolution. So congratulations to him, and appreciate the work of my friend Brian Bernadoni in getting that done as well. There you go. See, we're always up to date on things. Well, joining me now here in the Skyline studio is my good friend Michael Golden. Michael is president of Golden Means Strategies, a man of many hats, as it were. I can't keep track of all of it.
Scrabble hat, too. I may stop by that deal.
That would be great. I encourage you to come by.
I'm an admitted super nerd Scrabble guy from my childhood, believe it or not.
Really?
Yep.
All right. Well, let's go from Scrabble to Scramble here as we talk about the decision by Nancy Pelosi to formally embrace a move towards impeachment of President Donald Trump. You're no Trump fan. We know that. Okay.
What do you mean?
But is impeachment really the right road here? Is that subject to debate anymore?
Well, it's there's two sides of it, right? There's the politics of it, and then there's the sheer historic government responsibility laid out in the Constitution, and that there's been a tension between those two, right, for a year and a half. But obviously, a week ago or a few days ago, it ramped up. First of all, those seven congressmen,
freshmen,
and women, right? The freshmen who wrote in the Washington Post one day, we've tried to resist this. We can't do it any longer with what's happened and what we've learned, just the little bit we've learned. And, you know, then more dominoes started to fall. And, you know, within 24 hours, Nancy Pelosi, who's, fought against this, she has really resisted this. And it hasn't been easy for her, that was it. She was all in. But I think also the reason she did it is because she can see the storyline getting sold to a large majority of Americans, unlike all the other stuff. It's easier to understand.
And I was going to get to that, is the fact that this is a more, I would say, clean, in a way, of the issue, and that the Mueller report and issues of Russian involvement, and, you know, while there was plenty of people convicted as a result of this, but it was too much for people, the general public, to grasp their hands around, and that this is a much simpler case to lay out.
Yeah, and you know, the Republicans were making the case, I think effectively, during that whole Mueller time, which felt like 5 years, but they were making the case effectively that, well, there's, quote, there's no underlying crime. So all this obstruction is just a president fighting back against a storyline that's not true, and that'll come out, and you can't impeach somebody for, you know, doing these things. Now, if you're a lawyer, I don't know any lawyer that would say that's true. Obstruction of justice is a serious felony, and actually, it's what the justice system is based on. You know, cooperating with justice, not obstructing it. But you could see, I think people could understand that case more. Well, he did all this stuff, but he didn't really. There's not a crime they absolutely pinned on him. By the way, he did this call with Ukraine the next day after the Mueller thing had basically died, after I think that the testimony. So the brazenness of it, I mean, it's hard to everybody keeps saying, oh my God, the brazenness, how it did another level. I don't know if it's another level. I just think that he can't stop his mouth, and that's why I thought a year and a half ago, I said, I don't think he makes it through the term, because he can't stop talking. All the things that he does, including the things that may be illegal or certainly unethical, he talks about them. He doesn't care. He didn't think there was anything wrong with it. Meanwhile, you have 6 to 8 aides scrambling to figure out how to, right after the call, how do we not have this get in front of the public? So,
and then I think you add to that the issue that the whistleblower says is that this isn't the only call that was placed on a secret probation storage system somewhere, that there are other calls. And you have the Washington Post, you know, suggesting, has a story involving who those calls might be with.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. If you think about, just to boil it down to just human nature, if you think about 3 or 4 people or a family of 4, right, and the 3 people agree not to say something to the 4th because they don't want to hurt his feelings or something. Just for example, right? That it gets scrambled sometimes. That's a cover-up. You're basically covering something up for the benefit of somebody that you love. Now, in a massive bureaucracy that is the government, and including every single department is a massive bureaucracy, once there's something that they're trying to cover up, or what you can call it hide, you can call it, you know, but these emails were going back and forth, it would seem, you know, that said, we don't know how to handle this. What are we going to do? And, you know, unless you're in a room with nobody in the middle, you know, in the cloud, the people hear about this. And in government, people talk. So you're going to hear from a lot more people, I suspect, in these hearings, unless they say they claim, you know, executive privilege on everything. But the Democrats have done something smart already. And they've said in these subpoenas that if you do not agree to the power of Congress laid out in the Constitution to have you appear in
or produce documents,
right, and testify, this will be part of
the record.
Part of the obstruction charges that are included in a potential impeachment. That's
laying it out pretty strong.
That could get people talking.
Well, and so I know that's the language that's being used for Mike Pompeo,
right,
to come forward and produce documents. I played this clip earlier of the acting director of National Intelligence. Now, he's come under criticism for not conveying the whistleblower's complaint to Congress in a timely
fashion.
Before
the White House. Before going to the White House first.
Before going and then going to the White House to say, well, how do you guys respond to this? But I did think the fact when he said he's never seen a whistleblower report that had issues of such significance.
And thoroughness
that he wasn't quite sure how to handle it himself.
Right, exactly. And I know a couple of people who used to work in the intelligence community, and they said the same thing, just sort of in conversations in the last few days, that if you read this thing, there's nothing left unattended to. It is very detailed, very professional, and anticipated a lot of the questions that this person and the argument are going to get and are getting already.
It's remarkable that you have a whistleblower complaint that leads to questions about executive privilege.
I was a Watergate, another nerdy habit, right, in college, right?
When you were playing Scrabble.
Right, 1983, it was in college, or 1987, I should say. And I started reading everything I could about Watergate, and I was just fascinated by it. All the President's Men is possibly my favorite movie of all time. Not political, favorite movie, even though you knew what was going to happen. But I never thought I would see anything even close to Watergate in my lifetime. And in some ways, this is blown past Watergate in some ways. The public nature of it, you know. The leaks are going to reporters so fast that they don't need to investigate the same way Woodward and Bernstein did. I mean, a lot of them do on other issues, and he may be impeached on a dozen. You know, it's an indictment, basically a political indictment.
Right.
They may lop the other stuff in there just for good measure, but really focus on this most recent episode. But I'm still surprised by it. I don't know why, but I'm still surprised when I see this kind of behavior. And sort of an ignorance about history.
We're speaking with Michael Golden. He's president of Golden Means Strategies. We're talking about the action by the House to move forward with impeachment proceedings against President Donald Trump. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the WGN Skyline studio, joined by Michael Golden, president of Golden Means Strategies. We're talking about the House Democrats' decision to move forward with impeachment proceedings against President Trump. New ABC News Ipsos poll this morning, that nearly two-thirds of Americans believe Trump's encouragement of Ukraine's president to investigate Hunter Biden is a serious problem. 63%. That's 43% consider it very serious, 21% somewhat serious, and 36% say it's not so serious or not so serious at all. Another finding of this poll, however, is that only 17% said they were surprised by the president's actions.
This is what we were just talking about. That's astonishing.
17% were surprised. Let's talk about the issue, and we were talking about this off the air, about this is about precedent. And you have felt, you know, Congress, and you've written about Unlock Congress, your book, and just how Congress has been weakened as an institution for quite some time.
There's no question. You know, it's funny, the White House is referred to sometimes as the People's House. The People's House is the House of Representatives. It was set up as such, two-year terms, and representatives who really, their first job, people forget or don't know, is to get reelected. That's how this was set up in the beginning. Not to be for 40 years like it is now, these careers. But there are bedrock principles. You know, I'd hate to sound like my professor choose. but these things matter. And we were just talking about, Rick and I off the air, how after Watergate, there were consequences. They changed made the FISA courts, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. You know, they made it much more rigorous to do the kind of things that President Nixon was having the intelligence community do illegally, the president. And then also campaign finance acts. That's where it was really born out of post-Watergate, because all the cash that was flowing around to pay off people to do, you know, these covert activities. So, you know, President Clinton, for people who say, oh, he shouldn't have been, he should never have been impeached, you know, it was a sex scandal, it was a personal thing, da-da-da-da. Well, he perjured himself. That is a serious felony. Now, you can argue whether he should have been convicted, and he wasn't, of course. And the Republicans, you heard, you played Lindsey Graham earlier. 20 years ago, Senator Lindsey Graham said, this is about behavior, this is about cleansing, quote, cleansing the office. So, you know, that crime, such as it was nothing compared to the at least accusations or admissions that we're talking about now. And here's the thing. Impeachment is political. It is, right? By virtue of people,
yes,
right, having to make considerations.
It's not a pure legal process.
It's not like a mock inquiry in a classroom. Right. However, at a certain point, and this is what they have to decide, and they have at least in the House, you've got to at least do an investigation, a formal investigation that's called now, you know, an impeachment inquiry, and have a vote on the floor. Because if you don't, especially, I'm talking about right now, if you don't, with all the things that this president has been accused of or admitted himself, then there's no oversight in the future. A precedent is set to allow any future president, Republican, Democrat, independent, or otherwise, to do whatever they want. They'll say, well, if they didn't hold Donald Trump's feet to the fire when he did these 15 things, why would we have an impeachment vote? Why would we hold this president's feet to the fire for X? So this stuff matters in the course of history, but we've become so blinded by our polarized politics, how partisan we all are, and that includes the representatives in Congress and in the Senate. This is a lot of what my book was about, that the rules make that, you know, about how you get elected and the money and all of that stuff make it harder to cooperate and negotiate in good faith. So we're in a bad spot. And really what Donald Trump is, he's just set the thing on fire, right? He didn't start this, but, you know, he blew through the door. And that makes all of this harder. An impeachment inquiry looks even more political, no matter what the alleged crimes are.
Does it hurt Democrats in the end? With the belief that the Senate will not convict.
You know, I'm actually glad you asked this. I hadn't thought about that before we were going to talk today, but I'm glad you asked it, because I think a lot of people forget, and this includes presidential politics, the people running to be president. You know, there's all this stuff about Joe Biden. Well, he's the safe pick. Da, da, da. The people that win are usually people that nobody thought would win, but they inspire. They either are likable or have strength or both. And you can go back over 40 years. Kennedy, Reagan, Clinton. W was very much likable, and Al Gore, and I've seen him live and met him, and he's great in person but terrible in front of a camera. And then Barack Obama was incredibly inspirational. And Trump, say what you want about him, he projected strength. So to your question about the Democrats, a lot of people think, and I agree that they should have done it 8 months ago. Now, if they do this quickly for a few months and they do it correctly and they don't get over their skis with their mouths, right, which there's always a few that go too far. But I think that you show strength, let the chips fall, and then you're going to have another 6 to 8 months to get back to a presidential race. So I don't think so. I don't.
But there's some caveats in that statement,
sure,
some big
sure,
and some big ifs. Michael Golden, president of Golden Means Strategies, thank you so much for joining me this
morning. Always fun to be here. I love the spin.